I'm a martyr nonetheless.
The trees will burn for a week in the name of Lawrence Zai, the Emperor said.
Adept.
The two dead persons stood before a wreckage, the broken and burned shapes of data bricks scattered across the floor of the library.
Was it here?
Yes, Adept. Did the Rix abomination find it?
We don't know, Adept.
How can we not know? Trevum said quietly. The initiate shifted uncomfortably. He looked nervously at the walls, although every noise-sensitive device in the library had been physically deactivated. The abomination cannot hear us. The initiate cleared his throat. The one-time pad was concealed as a set of checksum garbage at the ends of other files. Only the few honored mothers studying the child empress's condition knew how the scheme worked. There was no way for the abomination to know how to compile the data and recreate the pads. Adept Trevum narrowed her eyes.
Could it not use trial and error?
Adept, there are millions of files here. The combinations are not limitless. Not if all the data were here. But it would take centuries, Adept.
For a single computer, millennia.
But for the processing capabilities of an entire world, every unused portion of every device on Legis devoted to this single problem, massively distributed and absolutely relentless. The initiate closed his eyes, removing himself from the shallow world of the sensors. Adept Trevum watched the young dead man let the other take control, the symbiont visible upon his face as it transformed hurried suppositions into hard math. It would have been quicker to employ a machine, but the apparatus avoided technology even in the best of circumstances. With the Rix abomination loose in the Legis infrastructure, they kept to the techniques given by the symbiont. To trust a processor would be unthinkable. Trevum waited motionless for just over an hour. The initiate opened his eyes. The state of emergency was still in partial effect when the library was broken into, he said. The adept nodded. With the markets closed, the media feed suspended, the population locked down, the planet's infrastructure would be largely dark. The abomination would have ample excess processor power at its disposal. It would have taken only minutes to run every permutation against the data it had recovered from the Confidant. When the correct order was hit upon by chance, the data would take on a recognizable form, the initiate concluded.
It knows, then.
The initiate nodded, looking queasy as he considered the secret in the hands of Rix abomination. We must assume it does, Adept. Trevum turned from the jumble on the floor. It had seemed so sensible a place to hide the one-time pads that would decrypt the recordings of the child empress's confidant. Rather than keeping the pads in a military installation under lock and key, a target for treachery or infiltration, the apparatus had hidden them among the chaos here at this library, a sequestered and little-accessed partition at the edge of the planet's infrastructure. The pads were here as a last resort, for when the Empress suffered the ultimate result of her infirmity. But with the Rix abomination and its last commando running free on the planet, the clever hiding place had worked against them. Even within the apparatus, only a few people knew how the Confidant worked, and these lived in the grey enclaves, far from any communication or even ready transport. It had taken hours to discover this weak point in the Emperor's secret. The compound mind had known where to look, though. The telling details could have come from anywhere. The shipping manifests of repair components, long-lost schematics, even from within the Confidant itself. Based on her examination of the device's remains, Initiate Fair was certain that the abomination had briefly occupied it just before the rescue had begun. The mind was everywhere. They had to destroy it, whatever the cost to its host world.
What do we do, Adept?
First, we must see that the contagion does not spread. Are there any translite communications the abomination could use to make contact with the rest of the Empire?
There is none, Adept. The Lynx's infrastructure is secure, and there are no other ships in the system with their own translite. Planetside, the entanglement facility at the Pole is under Imperial control.
Let us pay the Pole a visit and make sure.
Certainly, Adept.
They walked up the stairs, leaving a ruin of secrecy behind them. Destroy this building.
But, Adept, this is a library, the initiate said. Many of the documents here are single copy, secured. They're irreplaceable.
Nanomolecular disintegration. Melt it into the ground.
The militia won't.
They'll follow an Imperial writ, or they'll feel a blade of error, initiate. If they feel squeamish, we'll have the Lynx do it from space. See what they think about losing a few square kilometers. The initiate nodded, but the marks of emotion on his face disturbed the adept. What was it about this crisis that afflicted the honored dead with the weaknesses of the living? Perhaps it was the conditioning, the distress they had been trained to suffer even at the mention of the secret. The mental firewall that had preserved their silence for 16 centuries might be a liability now that the apparatus had to act rather than merely conceal. But perhaps there was more than conditioning behind the initiate's anguish. The abomination of the Rix compound mind surrounded them had imbued itself into the very planet. Now that the thing knew the secret, it threatened them on every front. The militia will relent, initiate. They must. But this one library will not be enough. We will have to repair this breach at its source. But the mind has propagated beyond any possibility of elimination. We must destroy it. But how, adept? However the Emperor commands. Captain. Captain Lawrence Zai stared past the airscreen and into the ancestral painting on the wall behind it. 3 meters by two, the artwork filled one bulkhead of his cabin. It reflected almost no light, only a ghostly luminescence, as jet as if the frigate's hull had suddenly disappeared, leaving a gaping hole into the void beyond. It had been painted by his grandfather, Astor Zai, 20 years after the old patriarch's death and just before he had started on the first of many pilgrimages. Like most Vaden ancestrals, it was composed with handmade paints, pigment from powdered black stone suspended in animal marrow, mixed with the whites of chicken eggs. Over the decades, the egg white rose to the surface of Vaden black paintings, giving them their lustrous sheen. The painting glowed softly, as if it were highlighted by a thin coat of rime on some cold, dewy morning. Otherwise, the rectangle was featureless. The dead claimed otherwise. They said they could see the brushstrokes, the layers of primer and paint, and more than that. They could see characters, arguments, places, whole dream stories painted within the blackness, like images in tea leaves or a crystal ball. But the dead claimed that reading the paintings was no trick, but straightforward signification, no more magical than a line of text calling an image into a reader's mind. The minds of the living were simply too cluttered to interpret a canvas so pure. Zai could see nothing. Of course, that absence of understanding was a sign with its own meaning. For the moment, he was still alive. In second sight, hovering before the painting, were the orders from the Navy. The Emperor's seal pulsated with the red light of its fractal authenticity weave, like a coat of arms decorated with live embers. The shape was familiar, the language traditional, but in their own way, the orders were quite as inscrutable as the black rectangle painted by an ancestor. The door chime sounded. Hobbs, here on the double. Zai erased the orders from the air. Come. His executive officer entered, and Zai waved her to the chair on the other side of the airscreen table. She sat down, her back to the black painting, her face guarded and almost shy. Zai's crew seemed reluctant to meet his eye since he had rejected the blade of error. Were they ashamed of him? Surely not Cathery Hobbs. She was loyal to a fault. New orders, Captain Zai said. And something else. Yes, sir? An imperial pardon. For a moment, Hobbs's usually rigid composure failed her. She gripped the arms of the chair, and her mouth gaped. Are you well, Hobbs? Zai asked. Of course, sir, she managed. Indeed, I'm very glad, Captain. Don't be too hasty. Her expression remained confused for a moment, then changed to surety. You deserve it, sir. You were right to reject the blade. The Emperor has simply recognized the truth. None of this was your Hobbs, he interrupted. The Emperor's mercy isn't as tender as you think. Take a look. Zai reactivated the airscreen. It showed the Legis system now. The Lynx in orbit around 15, the high vector of the incoming Rix battlecruiser. It took Hobbs only a few seconds to grasp the situation. A second attack on Legis, sir, she said, with more firepower this time. Considerably more, Hobbs. But that doesn't make sense, Captain. The Rix have already captured the planet. Why would they attack their own mind? Zai didn't answer, giving his executive officer time to think. He needed to have his own suspicions confirmed. Your analysis, Hobbs. She took her time, more iconographics cluttering the airscreen as she tasked the Lynx tactical AI with calculations. Perhaps this was the backup force, sir, in case the situation on the ground was still in doubt. A powerful ship to support the raiders if they weren't entirely successful, she said, working through the possibilities. Or more likely, this is a reconnaissance in force to discover if the raid succeeded. In which case? When the Rick's commander contacts the compound mind and realizes it has successfully propagated on the planet, they'll back off. Then, for the Lynx's disposition, what would your tactical recommendation be? Sai asked. Hobbs shrugged, as if it were obvious. Stay close to Legis 15, sir. With the Lynx supporting the planetary defenses, we should have enough firepower to keep a battlecruiser from damaging Legis, if that's their mission, which it probably isn't. The Ricks will most likely keep going once they realize the raid was successful. That'll carry them deeper into the Empire. We could try to track them. At 10% or so of the constant, they'd be hard for the Lynx to catch from a standstill, but a pursuit drone could manage it in the short term. Sai nodded. As usual, Hobbs's thinking roughly paralleled his own. Until he'd read the Lynx's orders, that is. We've been commanded to attack the battlecruiser, Hobbs. She simply blinked. Attack, sir? To intercept it as far out as possible, outside the planetary defenses, in any case, in an attempt to damage the Rick's communications gear. We're to keep the Rick's ship from contacting the compound mind. A frigate against a battlecruiser? Hobbs protested. But, sir, that's... Her mouth moved, but silently. Suicide, he finished. She nodded slowly, staring intently into the colored whorls of the airscreen. However quickly Hobbs had grasped the tactical facets of the situation, the politics seemed to have left her speechless. Consider this as an intelligence issue, Hobbs, Sai said. We've never had a compound mind fully propagate on an imperial world. It knows everything about Legis. It could reveal more about our technology and culture than the apparatus wants the Ricks to know. Or... Hobbs looked up into his eyes, still hammered into silence. Or, he continued, the Lynx may have been chosen to suffer the sacrifice that I was unwilling to make myself. There, he had said it aloud. The thought that had tortured him since he'd received the pardon and the orders, the two missives paired to arrive and be read together as if to indicate that neither could be understood without the other. He saw his own distress reflected in Hobbs's face. There was no other interpretation. Captain Lawrence Zai, elevated, had doomed his ship and his crew, had dragged them all down along with his miserable self. Zai turned his eyes from the still speechless Hobbs and tried to fathom what he felt, now that he had spoken his thoughts aloud. It was hard to say. After the tension of the rescue, the bitter ashes of defeat, and the elation of rejecting suicide, his emotions were too worn to keep going. He felt dead already. Sir, Hobbs finally began, this crew will serve you, will follow any orders. The Lynx is ready to... Her voice failed her again. Die in battle? She took a deep breath. To serve her emperor and her captain, sir. Catherine Hobbs's eyes glittered as she said the words. Lawrence Zai waited politely as she gathered herself, but then he uttered the words he had to say. I should have killed myself. No, Captain, you weren't at fault. The tradition does not address the issue of blame, Cathery. It concerns responsibility. I'm the captain. I ordered the rescue by tradition. It was my error of blood. Hobbs worked her mouth again, but Zai had chosen the right words to preempt her arguments. In matters of tradition, he, Avaden, was her mentor. On the utopian world she came from, not one citizen in a million became a soldier. In Zai's family, one male in three had died in combat over the past 5 centuries. Sir, you're not thinking of... He sighed. It was a possibility, of course. The pardon did not prevent him from taking his own life. The act might even save the Lynx. The Navy was not above changing its orders. But something in Lawrence Zai had changed. He'd thought that the threads of tradition and obedience that formed his being were bound together. He'd thought that the rituals and oaths, the sacrifice of decades to the time thief, and the dictates of his upbringing had reached critical mass, forming a singularity of purpose from which there was no escape. But it had turned out that his loyalties, his honor, his very sense of self, had all been held in place by something quite delicate, something that could be broken by a single word. Don't, he thought to himself, and smiled. I am thinking, Cathery, of going home. Hobbs was silenced by the words. She must have been ready to argue with him, to plead against the blade again. He took a moment, letting her renewed shock subside, then cleared his throat. "Let us plan a way to save the Lynx, Hobbs." Her still glittering eyes moved to the airscreen display, and Zai saw her gather herself in its shapes. He recalled what the War Sage, Anonymous 167, had once said. "Sufficient tactical detail will distract the mind from the death of a child, even from the death of a god." "High relative velocity," Hobbs began after a while, "with full drone complement deployed, I'd say. Narrow hull configuration. And standard lasers in the primary turrets. We'd have a chance, sir." "A chance, Hobbs?" "A fighting chance, sir." He nodded his head. For a few moments after the orders had come, Lawrence Zai had wondered if the crew would continue to accept his command. He had betrayed everything he had been raised to believe. Perhaps it would be fitting if his crew betrayed him. But not his executive officer. Hobbs was a strange one, half-utopian and half-grey. The face was a reminder of that. Moulded to an arresting beauty by the legendary surgeons of her hedonistic world, but always shrouded with a deadly serious expression. Generally, she followed tradition with the passion of the converted, but at certain times she questioned everything. Perhaps at this moment the gap between them had closed, her loyalty and his betrayal at the juncture of the risen empire. "A fighting chance, then," he said. "No more can a soldier ask for, sir," she quoted the sage. "And the rest of the crew?" "Warriors all, sir." He nodded and hoped she was right. Militia worker. Second-class militia worker Rana Harter stepped back nervously from the metal skirts of the Polar Maglev as it settled onto the track. The train floated down softly as if it weighed only a few ounces and sighed a bit as it descended, drifting along the track a few centimeters on a thin leftover cushion of air, like a playing card dealt across a glass table. But the delicacy was deceptive. Rana Harter knew that the Maglev was hypercarbon and hull alloy, a fusion reactor and 100 private cabins done in teakwood and marble. It massed more than 1,000 tons, would crush a human foot under its skirts as surely as a diamond-tipped tunneling hammer. Harter stood well back as the entry stairway unfolded before her. There was plenty of room here on the platform. Tiny Galileo township seldom provided passengers for the Maglev, which could have easily accommodated its entire population. This stop, the last before the polar cities of Maine and Jutland, was mostly to take on supplies. But militia worker Rana Harter was at last going to step onto the train. She had lived here in the Galileo administrative prefecture her entire life. Her new posting to the Polar Entanglement Facility would be the first time she had left the Gap. Rana waited for someone to appear at the top of the entry stairway, someone to invite her aboard the intimidating train. But the stairway waited, impassive and empty. She looked at her ticket, actually a sheaf of plastic chits, ribbed with copper-coloured circuitry and scribble codes, which the local Legius Militia office had provided her. There wasn't much on the ticket that was human-readable. Just the time when the train would leave, and something that looked like a seating assignment. The northern tundra of Legius 15 seemed to stretch out, infinitely huge around her. Rana waited at the bottom of the stairway. She couldn't bring herself to go through a door without an invitation. Here in Galileo Township, such boldness felt like trespassing. But after a half minute or so, the warning lights along the stairs began to flicker, and the ambient hum of the entire Maglev raised a bit in pitch. It was now or never, she realized. Had she waited too long? Would the stairway fold up as she climbed it, crushing her like a doll in the gears of a bicycle? She placed one tentative foot on the lowest step. It felt solid enough, but the Maglev's whine was still climbing. Rana took a quick breath and held it, and dashed up the stairway. She was just in time, or perhaps the stairway had been waiting for her. At the top, Rana turned around to take a last look at her hometown, and the stairs folded themselves back up, curling into a single spiral that irised, closed like an umbrella. And Rana Harter, flushed more from nerves than from the short climb, was inside the train that would take her to the pole. Her seat was several minutes' walk toward the front of the train. The Maglev's acceleration was so even that when Rana looked out the window, she was surprised to see the landscape already whipping by, the snow and scrub grass smeared to a shimmering milky blur. Rana knew that her reassignment had been the result of the Rick's attack a few days before. The Legis militia was shifting onto war footing, and she'd read that strategic targets like the entanglement facility were being heavily reinforced. But as she passed the hundreds of soldiers and workers on the train, the scale of the Rix threat finally struck her. The maglev seemed full. Every seat was occupied until she reached the one that matched her ticket. Rana's nerves twinged again, her guilt rising like a tardy schoolchild's as she took the last empty seat. The soldier next to her was sleeping, his chair pitched back so that it was almost a bed. Her seat was certainly comfortable, designed for half-day journeys. A small array of controls floated in synesthesia before her, marked with the standard icons for water, light, entertainment, and help. She waved them away and folded herself into one corner of the chair. Rana Harta wondered why she had been assigned to the entanglement facility. Surely it was the most important installation on Legis 15. But what could the militia need her there for? She wasn't any kind of soldier. The only weapon she was rated to use was a standard field auto pistol, and you could empty a whole clip from one of those into a Rix commando without much effect. She'd failed her combat physical and didn't have the coordination for a quick interface job like remote pilot or sniper. The only thing Rana had turned out to be good at, the reason she'd made second class in just a year, was microastronomy. Rana Harta had a brain bug, it turned out, something her aptitude officer called holistic processing of chaotic systems. That meant she could look at the internal trajectories of a cluster of rocks, asteroids in the under-kilogram category, and tell you things about it that a computer couldn't, like whether it was going to stick together for the next few hours or break up, threatening a nearby orbital platform. Her CO explained that even the smartest Imperial AIs couldn't solve that kind of problem because they tried to plot every rock separately, using millions of calculations. If there was even the slightest observational imprecision at the front end, the back end results would be hopelessly screwed up. But brain bugs like Rana saw the swarm as one big system, a whole. In deep synesthesia, this entity had a flavor, smell, sound to it. A deep, stable odor like coffee or the shaky tang of mint, ready to fly dangerously apart. But why send her to the polar facility? Rana had used equipment like the repeater array up there and even performed field repairs on small repeater gear. But they didn't do astronomy at an entanglement grid, just communications. Maybe they were retooling the facility for defense work. She tried to imagine tracking a swarm of enemy ships dodging through the Legis defenses. What would the Rix taste like? Movement in her peripheral vision distracted Rana from these thoughts. Standing in the aisle was a tall militia officer. The woman glanced up at the seat number, then down at Rana. Rana Harta? Yes, ma'am. Rana tried to stand at attention, but the luggage rack over her head made that impossible, and she saluted from a crouch. The officer didn't return the gesture. The woman's expression was unreadable. She was wearing full interface glasses that entirely obscured her eyes, which was odd because she also had a portable monitor in her hands. She wore a heavy coat, even in the well-heated train. There was a bird-like quickness to her motions. Come with me, the officer ordered. Her voice was husky, the accent unplaceable. But then, Rana had never been out of the Gap except in videos. The officer turned and walked away without another word. Rana grabbed her kit bag from the rack and wrestled it into the aisle. By the time she looked up, the woman was almost through to the next car, and Rana had to run to catch her. The officer was headed toward the back of the train. Rana followed, barely able to keep up with the taller woman. She banged another worker with her flailing kit bag and muttered an apology. He answered with a phrase Rana didn't recognize, but which didn't sound polite. At the frantic pace, they soon reached the luxury section. Rana stopped, her mouth agape. One side of the carpeted corridor was filled entirely by a floor-to-ceiling window. In it, the tundral landscape rushed by furiously, blurred into a creamy palette by the train's speed. Rana had read that the maglev could make 1,000 clicks per hour. Right now, it seemed to be doing twice that. Across from the window was a wall of dark paneled wood, broken by doors to private cabins. The silent officer walked slowly here, as if more comfortable out of the crowded coach sections. They passed a few servants in maglev line uniforms who stood at attention. Rana wasn't sure whether their stiff posture was out of respect for the officer or just to give them room to pass in the thin corridor. Finally, the officer entered one of the doors, which opened for her without a hand key or even a voice command. Rana followed nervously. The cabin was beautiful. The floor was some kind of resin, an amber surface that gave softly under Rana's boots. The walls were marble and teak wood. The furniture was segmented. Rana's brain ability asserted itself, and she saw how each piece would fold around itself, the chairs and table transforming into a desk and a bed. A wide window revealed the rushing tundra. The cabin was larger than Rana's old barrack hut at Galileo, which she shared with three other militia workers. The luxury of the surroundings only made Rana more nervous. She was obviously inadequate for whatever special operation she'd been assigned to. She felt guilty, as if she were already screwing things up. Sit down. Here in the quiet cabin, Rana listened carefully to the officer's strange accent. It was precise and careful, with the exact pronunciation of an AI language teacher. But the intonation was wrong, like a congenital deaf-mute's, carefully trained to use sounds that she herself had never heard. Rana dropped her kit bag and sat in the indicated chair. The officer sat across from her, a decimeter taller than Rana, even with them both seated. She took off her glasses. Rana's breath stopped short. The woman's eyes were artificial. They reflected the white landscape passing in the window, but were brilliant with a violet hue. But it wasn't the eyes that had made her gasp. With the glasses removed, Rana could finally see the shape of the officer's face. It was eerily recognizable. The hair wasn't familiar, and the violet eyes were almost alien. But the line of the woman's jaw, the cheekbones and high forehead were all strangely like Rana's own. Rana harder shut her eyes. Perhaps the resemblance was just the result of nerves and lack of sleep, a momentary hallucination that a few seconds of darkness could erase. But when she looked again, the woman was just as familiar, just as much like Rana herself. It was like peering into an enhancing mirror at a cosmetic surgery store, one that added a hair weave or different colored eyes. She was transfixed by the effect, unable to move. Militia worker Rana Harter, you have been selected for a very important mission. That oddly inflected voice again, as if the words came from nowhere, were owned by no one. Yes, ma'am, what kind of mission? The woman tilted her head as if the question surprised her. She paused a moment, then looked at her handheld monitor. I cannot answer that now, but you must follow my orders. Yes, ma'am. You will stay in this cabin until we reach the pole. Understood? I understand, ma'am. The woman's precise tone began to calm Rana a bit. Whatever mission the militia wanted her for, they were giving clear enough orders. That was one thing she liked about the militia. You didn't have to think for yourself. You are to speak to no one but me on this train, Rana Harter. Yes, ma'am, Rana answered. May I ask one question, though? The woman said nothing, which Rana took as permission to continue. Who exactly are you, ma'am? My orders didn't say... The woman interrupted immediately. I am Colonel Alexandra Hurd, Legis 15 Militia. She produced a colonel's badge from the voluminous coat. Rana swallowed. She'd never even seen anyone with a rank over captain before. Officers existed on a lofty level that was utterly mysterious when viewed from her own small nervous world. But she hadn't realized how truly strange they could be. The colonel pointed at the corner of the room and a wash basin unfolded itself elegantly from the wall. Wash your hair, she ordered. My hair? Rana asked, dumbfounded anew. Colonel Hurd pulled a knife from her pocket. The blade was almost invisibly thin, a shimmering presence as it caught light reflected from the patches of snow passing the window. The handle was curved in a strange way that made Rana think of a bird's wings. The colonel held it with her fingertips, a sudden grace evident in her long fingers. After you have washed your hair, I will cut it off, Colonel Hurd said. I don't understand. And a manicure, and a good scrubbing. What? Orders. Rana Harter did not respond. Her mind had begun to whir, to accelerate into a blur as featureless as the passing landscape. It was her brain bug, going for a quick flight, buzzing toward that paralyzing moment when a host of incoherent, chaotic input suddenly resolved into understanding. She could just glimpse the operations of the savant portion of her mind, the maelstrom of an Alessandra madly arranging itself, seeking to collapse from a meaningless flurry into something concrete and comprehensible. The curve of the colonel's knife, somehow like an outline remembered from a ship-spotting course in her astronomy training, the strange, placeless accent, the words slow and prompted, the collection of hair, fingernails, skin, the colonel's inhuman eyes, and the woman's avian movements that fluttered like sunlight on bicycle spokes, the smell of lemongrass,